A life drawing, A Life Under Lights, the story of Jessica Martin's life under lights, from teenage jazz singer to television impressionist in the days when light entertainment was at its Saturday night best, to cult Doctor Who guest star, leading West End musical theatre actress, and now, over the past years, a comic creator and public graphic novelist. Life Drawing chronicles the people, places, experiences that have shaped her life and career, all rendered in Jessica's comic book storytelling style. It's a marvellous work. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, Jessica Martin. Jessica, good morning to you.
A very good morning, Giles, and good morning, the Med. I guess the listeners are kind of scattered all over the Mediterranean, we're hoping.
Scattered is a word for them, yes. Shaken and dumped around various parts from Mallorca down to Gibraltar, and perhaps a few of them sort of scratching their heads and wondering what they're doing on the Atlantic coast. But yes, that's a good word for them. tell us a little bit about then the background behind Life Drawing, because you were born into a sort of, I don't want to say showbiz family, but there was definitely music and going on stage in the background.
Yes. So my late father, Edo Martin, Edo being short for Placido, as in Domingo, he wasn't Spanish, actually. He was from Singapore originally.
Right.
And he was of Filipino heritage. And I mentioned Filipino because I think a lot of people, and I hope I'm not sounding casually racist in saying it, but when they think of Filipino people, they think of, you know, people that are in the service industry and working in hotels, etc. But there is a talent that Filipino people have, and I speak on behalf of my father and all my ancestors before. They're an extremely musical race. And they pick up different styles of music that, you know, if you went to the Philippines, went to any sort of hotel bar and heard the entertainment, you know, the tribute acts would absolutely sound, well, you know, replicate the originals.
Well, Bruno Mars's parentage is Filipino as well, isn't it?
Sorry?
Bruno Mars has Filipino in his family as well. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I didn't know. I thought he was Latin American.
No. I think his mother's is Filipino. I'll check it out. But I've done reports. I've read articles with him, and he's got a Filipino heritage in there, definitely.
Oh, and Enrico Iglesias, his mother, I think,
of course,
is Filipino too. So,
yeah, absolutely. So there you go. Yes.
So anyway, so my father was actually a jazz musician, and my grandfather had been the orchestra leader at the Raffles Hotel in Singapore in the 1940s.
Oh, wonderful!
And he passed away early 1950s, and my father and his brother just sort of decided to go on this adventure. You know, let's go to Europe. Let's see what the jazz scene is like in London. So to cut to the chase, my father ended up being a kind of leading Latin American music band leader in Soho, London, in the 50s. And my mother, who hailed from Northern Ireland, my mother very sadly passed away a year and a half ago, but she met him. She was working in London as an international telephonist. It was the days, you know, when you see in movies, they have an international operator with those kind of spaghetti threads going into lots of different holes. And,
absolutely.
You know, your call has been put through, sir. So she was one of those girls, and she spoke fluent French. So she was living in London and living the life, going out to nightclubs, and met my father. And then to cut to my story, and then a little girl was sired by my mother and father
right.
Sometime in the early 60s. So my early childhood memories are of actually kind of being asked by my dad to get up and entertain various kind of musician friends of his who'd be over for a Sunday lunch, and it would be, oh, Jessica, can you get up? Come on, get up. Everybody's waiting for you to sing the theme from Stingray. Stingray, I'm sure there'll be some of the listeners.
Was that Marina Aquamarina, or was that Stingray
Singer? Marina Aquamarina.
That's the one, yeah, absolutely. Remember
yeah,
that.
Yeah, which was, I mean, honestly, that song was so beautiful. Gary Miller sang it, and I just remember that beautiful mermaid puppet, Marina.
Yep.
So that was my theme song, and I used to do sort of Dusty Springfield numbers and stuff like that. So, singing was never anything that I was particularly nervous about or thought there was a big deal about. And then some years later, when I got to kind of school age and and university age, added on to the desire to sing was the desire to sing and act. And my big hero was Judy Garland. I think I was about seven when she passed away, and there was this big news report on the television, and I just thought, oh my goodness me, who is this incredible goddess? I mean, she just was such an amazing force of nature. And, you know, I think there's a film coming out later this year, and Renee Zellweger is portraying her. And with all due respect to Renee and all the other people who played her, but there was only ever one Judy Garland, and her legend just kind of, you know, it gathers momentum with every passing year. So I think I picked a good heroine. And then, you know, for my how I got into the business, people get the full detail and get the, you know, the thing about a graphic novel is it's comic book form. So right. Where in a normal prose book, you're going to get long descriptions. And then I went to this space and it looked like this. I'm at the, you'll see me drawing the pictures of the locations and the people, you know, some of whom people will recognize. So the first personality, or shall we say famous person, who kind of helped me on the road to, I was going to say the road to perdition, but no, the road to... I'm actually thinking of writing the next book, which will be called Do Not Entertainment. But anyway, the first person who helped me on my way was Rory Bremner. And he was a student, same age as me. He was at a different college in London, but our paths crossed when we were at the Edinburgh Festival. We were both students. He was bringing the house down with amazing, you know, he used to do these impressions of, I remember it's Fife Robertson, this Scottish presenter, used to wear the kind of Sherlock Holmes hat. I could hear him doing Fife Robertson and some cricket presenters. And he was just absolutely spot on. But the thing was that it kind of like the singing, it never occurred to me that it was any big deal. But I used to do, I used to call them voices. So, you know, for instance, we would be walking along the road to get to our venue at the Edinburgh Festival. It was a bit long and boring, so I'd suddenly burst into Julie Andrews and say, come on children, let's just sing a jolly song, follow me, do a dear, and so on and so on. And then we get to the venue, and then I just remember I could do the voices, but I'd never ever kind of stood on a stage and done impressions in an act per se. It was all, you know, just done for the amusement of my friends and relatives. And suddenly I was sort of thrown on this little stage, spotlight on me, and all my student friends just were shouting, oh, go on, do Kate Bush and do Barbara Streisand. So it kind of helped me with my no act act. And then the rest was kind of history, because a couple of years after that, I met up with Rory again, and he was doing a radio show called News Review, which was, I guess, sort of like, not Have I Got News For You, more of a topical sketch show, and they needed a girl who could do impressions of all the current personalities. And again, I didn't have, as far as I was concerned, the only credentials I had were the fact that I could change my voice, but I had no idea of the range or repertoire that I could possibly do. But there's nothing like jumping in the deep end and being given, oh, this week you're going to be Janet Street Porter, Yoko Ono and Margaret Thatcher. And you just get on with it. You just roll your sleeves and do the job as best you can.
And of course, that ended up with a gig, wasn't it? You ended up with Spitting Image, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And again, you know, I mean, this is how life goes. I'm sure everyone can attest to this, you know, whether or not they're in show business, that when you really want something and you're focusing on getting a specific thing, it just seems to elude you. And for me, the last thing that I wanted really, I wasn't interested in doing impressions. I wanted to sing and dance and act. I wanted to go to drama school. And then I was doing this radio show, and Rory said to me, oh, you know, we're doing tonight when we do our cabaret act, got a couple of guys from the Spitting Image production team. The writers are coming to see the show. Probably, you know, hopefully I'll be getting a gig on it. And anyway, the writers, Rob Grant and Doug Naylor, who are probably more famous now for being the writers of Red Dwarf, which has got yet another series. So they were the main writers and came to see the show. And I was doing Barbara Streisand and talking about doing Yentl. It's pronounced Yentl, not mental. And then I was like summoned to the writer's table, and they said they absolutely loved the Barbara Streisand, and would I like to audition for John Lloyd? Who's John Lloyd? John Lloyd was the producer of Spitting Image. And so literally I kind of went in a week later into John Lloyd's office and did a 20-minute, you know, the act I did, you know, kind of this naked impressionist act, basically. Right. And John Lloyd kind of turned around and said, yeah, well, the only thing is, you know, the puppet for Barbara Streisand is probably going to cost a lot. And let me have a look at my budget and get back to you. And suddenly, it's like the wheels were all in motion. And shortly after that audition, I got an audition for a show which I hope the listeners will remember fondly. I think quite a few people, when you mention it, they say, oh, my God, I do remember that show. So there was a wonderful show called Copycats, which was Saturday night, London weekend. It was six guys, and then the seventh person was me. I was the girl on it. And for that, I have to thank John Lloyd, because he recommended me to the producer, David Bell, who was looking for a girl who could complete the team. And he needed somebody who could sing as well as do the vocal speaky bits as well.
And the other thing, of course, is the fact that, you know, this is what, late 80s, early 90s, I'm thinking, just off the top of my head, or early 80s?
Mid-80s. So Copycats was 85, yeah, that I recorded the series, the very first series, I remember.
And, of course, Saturday Night used to be, I mean, before we had Strictly Come Dancing, Bake Off on Ice, Island, Get Me Out of Here, these reality TV series, I mean, that was Saturday Night TV, wasn't it? It was entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, well, people would argue, certainly I have this argument with my children who kind of scoff and laugh at me. Mummy's not famous anymore. If you want to be famous, you need to be on one of these, you know, you need to be on one of those shows. And it is entertainment of a kind, but it's an entertainment that is, you know, it's got a gladiatorial element. So people have got a certain, there's a will there. Not yet. Yeah, you want to see people succeed, but actually there's more joy in seeing people fall flat on their faces. So I think what was much more pure, if you like, about entertainment back in the day was it was entertainment to see a variety show with variety. So people could do lots of different things. And people were really thrilled that, oh, my God, look at that person doing whatever it is, a magic act or impressions in our case. So you felt kind of supported going out there, and not that, you know, it was kind of a do or die. You could either come out of this a millionaire overnight and a star of Instagram and all the rest of it, or you could end up seriously needing therapy. Mm. So there you go.
And of course, there was also the small matter of the Doctor Who appearances.
Yes. Well, do you know, again, this is the strange thing, how things kind of become, you know, time gives a veil of legend to the whole story. So the Doctor Who show was with Sylvester McCoy, who was the seventh Doctor. This is 1988, and I am called in to audition because basically the producer, John Nathan Turner at that time, was a massive fan of light entertainment, and he'd seen me doing an impression of Judy Garland on a show with Jimmy Tarbuck.
Okay, yeah.
And he just said to me, he said, Jessica, I really loved the Judy Garland impression. And, you know, I really thought somebody who, I mean, looking at you here, I assumed that you must be about 40 to be doing Judy Garland, but you look very young. And so, you know, your skills of character acting are definitely what we'd require for you to play a werewolf. So, yeah. Judy Garland to werewolf.
Werewolf, yes, I can see that. I can see that being a natural progression.
Yeah, well, she probably turned into a werewolf when she was trying to kind of negotiate the finer points of her contract with Louis B. Mayer, but we weren't there. We'll never know.
Well, either, or she went, you know, you never know how many munchkins she actually munched on behind the scenes, obviously.
but it was, wow, what a lucky, lucky turn of events for me, because I ended up being in Doctor Who. It wasn't lucky. At that time, Doctor Who was actually on its way out, and after Sylvester's series, BBC, in their not wisdom, axe the show, but there was a core of fans who just kind of kept the faith, and they one of the things they did was there was a platform for kind of Doctor Who stories that weren't going to be on television, but people wanted more Doctor Who stories. Where could they get them? There was an audio series created by a production company called Big Finish. And Big Finish have just celebrated their 20th anniversary, and they are massive. Anybody who's listening who's a Doctor Who fan knows exactly what I'm talking about, but they are, you know, they're kind of like the Amazon of anything to do with Doctor Who and cult TV. That's where you go for your kind of extra shot. And they recently created three new dramas for the character that I played in that series I was talking about. The character was called Mags. And they've got three writers to write incredibly diverse storylines for her in another dimension, another planet, and another scenario. So, you know, for a show that I did, and we won't count the years, but we know it's a long, long time ago, for it to kind of still have a following, and not only that, to kind of almost have a renaissance is something, you can imagine, something that pleases me very much.
And also, you've taken your one-woman show, and I always think the people who do, you know, I mean, I was lucky enough to see Ian McKellen years and years ago when he did his acting Shakespeare effort in the West End. You know, and a one-woman, and I was speaking to Berkoff about this when I interviewed him last year, but a one-person show or a one-man or one-woman show is a particularly hard act to pull off because, as the name, you know, as the name infers, you know, you're on your own out there.
Yes. So one-woman shows I've done plenty of in my time, and the one that I took out on the road for the longest had a character called Véronique Remand, and if you do the math, she should be about 100, but she looks amazing. She looks like a really well-preserved, slightly drag queen with the big hair and the lovely gown, and she has all these wonderful showbiz memories of people like Anne Miller and Debbie Reynolds, with whom she shares a birthday, but not, thank God, the same cosmetic surgeon. Oh, no, it's okay. She doesn't mind me saying that. She just smiles all the time.
Right.
So I have this very salty Broadway broad who's grown up in Hollywood, and as you can hear from the storyline, I mean, really, she is a reflection of me. But if I was born in a slightly earlier time in a different country, you know, and lived through the Hollywood golden age. So it was a perfect excuse for me to do the narration illustrated with, you know, movie star impressions of everybody from Bette Davis to, I don't think I did Meryl Streep in there, but I think if I updated, I definitely have to do her. and Cher. But it was, that was quite an adventure. They're not easy shows to pull off from the point of view that, I mean, you mentioned Ian McKellen, and of course he's always had a huge following, but of course now that he is Gandalf, I mean, even if he wasn't Ian McKellen with all the talent that he has in the world, it wouldn't be hard for him to fill a massive theatre because of his profile.
Sure.
So as I found out when I was doing a solo show, I forgot, you know, the thing about being an actor and you're involved in a show that's perhaps it's a show adapted from a film, so it's already got, you know, a platform there. These things, they all take time to build up, and sometimes it can be very difficult. So, you know, a lot of the time, doing the one-woman show was not the difficult thing. Publicizing it and kind of, without kind of doing the show for people in order to expect, it was a hard thing to sell. But I think that sometimes one does things and they can be slightly, this is a weird thing to say, it's ahead of its time, because I was doing obviously something that had a nostalgia appeal. But I think nowadays, because we have the, you know, we have social media, we have YouTube, it's much easier if you have a product or a show or something that you want to say, you can get your message out there and you can kind of promote it much more easily than maybe sort of 10 or 15 years ago.
So tell me a little bit about Life Drawing, because it's not your usual showbiz memoir about, you know, you and Tarby or you and Brucey or whatever. I mean, this is a graphic novel.
Yes. So a graphic novel is, it's a posh way for saying a long, a long-form comic, and that's what it is. And the reason why I've moved into this particular form of storytelling is because about 10 years ago now, I took up sketching, which is something that, you know, as people will see in the book, one of my childhood memories is, like so many children, of having a sketchbook and pen in my hand, drawing any time, anywhere. But the thing that particularly drew me, excuse the pun, was movie stars. I was always drawing movie stars that I loved on the television. I'd be making up stories about them, making up their names and backgrounds. So here I am, grown up. Although I'm not a movie star, I have got a story of showbiz to relate. And also, as I touched on, my unusual background and heritage and all of those things. And the other thing that I wanted to do was actually tell, if you like, the unvarnished truth about show business. That, you know, we always see on IMDb, you just see a string of credits. And, you know, in all the kind of celebrity memoirs, it's basically, it's more peaks than troughs. But the truth is that for everybody in show business, and it doesn't matter if they're, you know, they could be a massive movie star today, but these things, they don't last. And I think that in life, certainly I found in my own life, you have to find the things that are the keepers. So the keepers for me in life are, you know, my home and family are very, very important to me. I've got two teenage children, and even though they take the mickey out of me, you know, treat me like I'm Norma Desmond, I love them to bits, and they keep me grounded. And the other thing is this hobby that I did, this sketching, was in a way something that took me away from the constant, you know, actors' narcissistic thing of, oh, when is the phone going to ring? When is the next job? And actually, I got so absorbed in my hobby that I really couldn't care less. I was at a stage where, thankfully, you know, I mean, my husband has got a good job. I never had to worry about, you know, if I don't get a job, the mortgage isn't going to be paid. So I had the luxury of pursuing a hobby. But then, as if by magic, I was doing a production of Spamalot. I was doing a tour of it, playing the Lady of the Lake.
Right.
And I took my sketchbook with me, and my co-star, he was the star of the show, but Phil Jupitus, absolutely loves comics. And I showed him my sketchbook that I'd been taking around with me. He just looked at it and he said, "Oh, blimey," he said, "oh, you should be doing like a graphic novel. I mean, look at you, you know, you can obviously, if you're an actress, you can probably write a script, and then with that kind of drawing, you should, you know, put the two together, and you've got a graphic novel." As easy as that. Of course, it wasn't as easy as that. I spent the next year kind of doing a course of self-education, buying lots of books on Amazon, which, by the way, you can get my book on Amazon. That was very subtle.
Very, very subtle. Well done for that. I don't think anybody hardly noticed that plug at all.
But, you know, I literally kind of taught myself to draw, not only draw, but in comics, you have to be able to draw people in different settings. You have to draw the settings. You have to costume the characters. You're kind of almost, it's like a movie. It's like being the director, the designer, the writer, and the actor. So it was a marvelous thing. I mean, even if I never, ever sold a single comic, just that feeling that for once in my life, I've got, you know, I've got a story that I can tell, and there are no barriers to it. I can just put it down, and I can see it there. But the wonderful thing about the comics world, and it's a place I inhabit almost as much as I do my stage work, when you go to conventions, you get the big people who do, you know, your Marvel and DC, all the superheroes, but there are also a huge amount of what they call indie comic creators who they have their own stories that they write. They maybe draw themselves or somebody else draws them, and they get a following. They may not make a living from it, but it's a wonderful thing where they can express whatever story it is they want to tell. And they, believe me, there is, you know, as many different kind of genres of story in comics as there are in the prose form. But, you know, we're still kind of like, I feel about musical theatre and variety. We're still the bastard brother of the literary world. It's still one of those things that, oh, a graphic novel, that's novel. But, you know, it is a very cool thing. And I would encourage anybody, even if you're not interested in my particular story, but, you know, have a look when you go to a bookshop or if you're looking online, have a look at, under the graphic novel section, because you'll just be amazed by the variety of just the art is so beautiful and the storytelling is fantastic. And it's just midway between a book and a film. So it's almost like a film in stop motion.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of Neil Gaiman, The Sandman book.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, absolutely amazing. We're going to run out of time. I know I said off air probably about a 10-minute conversation. We've almost hit the half hour mark. Well done, Jessica. If people want to find out more about your fascinating story, it's a beautiful book. Where can they find you online? I'm looking at your website now anyway, but give us the full plug.
Okay, it's www.jessicamartinofficial.com. And actually, if you Google...
There are some fake Jessica Martins out there?
You will find me. I know there are other Jessica Martins, but I think I'm there at the top of the Google. And as I mentioned very unsubtly, the book is... just go on Amazon, put in Life Drawing Jessica Martin, and you'll find it.
And you'll be able to download it from the TRE virtual bookstore as well, so that makes it even easier for the public to go and pick up your excellent tome, Jessica.
Fantastic. Thank you, Giles. That's really lovely of you.
It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Jessica Martin, author of Life Drawing, A Life Under Lights. Thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure.